All right. I've been instructed to bring us back to order and launch forward. All right, so everyone refresh from your, just so you know, I'm treating you essentially like a seminary classroom, giving you everything I possibly can. So it's your own fault for coming and looking like you are interested in learning. So wouldn't do it if I didn't think you could handle it. But I definitely know there's a lot to these issues, so we're trying to do the best we can to talk about it. So we just finished talking about the traditional Reformed approach, talking about theonomy. Now, I would say it's gaining in popularity is this idea of principalism. And so these would be the steps that you would take to appropriately derive a principle and apply it. Okay, so you determine the original significance. So in other words, you find out what is the law doing in its context, and then you trace why it's doing that, and then you can talk about how do we then incorporate the principle into our own context. All right, so the way that we do this is partly by understanding the law structure. So we already talked a lot about this, so I don't need to talk too much about this. But remembering that the function of the law, the purpose of the law, also relates to where it fits into the law. Okay? So both in Exodus and Deuteronomy, there are indications of this. But even in Leviticus, you have splashover effect from this. So let's do some case studies. I think those are so helpful. So let's actually walk through how this would apply. And again, by the way, I would throw out there that I think a lot of what I say here would have overlap with some of the other views. It's just the methodology that's leading to the conclusion, okay? So there's going to be some overlap in the fact that we say the same thing, but how do we get there? As Christians, here's a little devotional thought, okay? I'm delaying myself, but this is important. Okay, a devotional thought, important in the middle of this, is that it's not enough to get the right answer as a Christian. In other words, the end isn't sufficient. It's also the means to the end, right? We don't, as Christians, say that the ends justify the means. The means and the ends are important, right? So it's not just about getting the right answer. You also have to be doing it the right way, because that's honoring to the Lord. That's the big push here. Okay, so case study, Exodus 22:1. If a man steals an ox or a sheep and kills it or sells it, he shall repay 5 oxen for an ox and 4 sheep for a sheep. All right, so that's pretty obvious. Now, the issue here, I don't know, how many of you own an oxen? An ox? I don't see any hands coming up. Okay, so the problem is we don't own an ox, right? What about, so the point is already we're dealing with principalization, no matter what view you're in, if you don't own that, right? So here's how we would work through Exodus 22:1. So the first thing that we do is we're trying to assess, we're trying to get back to a creational principle. Okay, that's the idea. That's the creational principles are what drive real application at all times. Okay, so looking at the law here, why is it we could answer it this way? Why is it wrong to steal? That could be an answer or the question. And so God created man and has given him real ownership, okay? Like, that's a creation principle. Man is made in the image of God. He's given him ownership, private property. All of those things are creational realities. Those aren't law realities. In other words, even if they're, well, here, this is actually a really good thought exercise. Is it wrong to steal because God said it's wrong to steal, or is it wrong to steal whether or not God said it was wrong to steal? Or insert killing. Would it have been wrong? Was it wrong for Cain to kill Abel? Or was he able to do it because God had never told him not to do it? You see the dilemma there is that there's something about right and wrong that transcends law. Okay, now, at the same time, I understand that theologians historically would use the term law, whatever. I think that just gets confusing because when we're talking about law, we're talking about Mosaic law, but then theologians often talk about law with regard to creation, whatever. So I'm making a distinction just to be more helpful, is that I'm trying to talk about it as creation ordinances or creation principles, and then law with regard to Mosaic law, or even specific command. We could say if God commands Abraham to get circumcised, sure, that's a law. But I'm making a distinction there. So this, the fact that God created man and has given him real ownership, is actually a creation principle. Now, as you look at how the law is structured, now this goes back to understanding, remember, the way that the law is ordered is that you have the Ten Commandments. Those are the foundational constitution for Israel. And then the specific case laws are the specific stipulations are the case laws that relate to that constitutional application, right? So what we have in Exodus 22:1 is a case law, which is a specific application in a scenario that relates to a general principle of don't steal, and the general command of not stealing is related to the creational ordinance or the creational principle of the fact that there's private property. God has created man for hard work and to be able to get recompense for his work. And so all these things are a part of our process of looking behind the law, right? So make repayment for theft is a very specific application of the principle of you shall not steal, which is a specific application in and of itself of the creational principle of the fact that God has created man and given him specific roles and responsibilities, and we're not to violate those. So the application then, if we're looking at this, the principle is that theft is wrong and restitution for theft is important, okay? So, I mean, restitution in general is important, even if it wasn't theft. The biblical law talks about how if you accidentally destroy somebody's ox or whatever, you still are obligated to take action in certain ways. And so this is something that still remains true today. Now, when I was growing up, I was riding my bike, I was racing along, I smashed it into the back of a car and destroyed a taillight. And so I told my dad, and he said, okay, what you need to do is you need to buy a new taillight for that person and put it in. And, well, he helped me because I was like 8 years old, but I couldn't really do it myself. But should I have given him, you know, like 4 taillights? Should I have given, would I have been wrong if I just gave him money? The point is that there's flexibility there. We're not bound to the norm. The law isn't normative on us, telling us with the letter what exactly needs to be accomplished. There's a principle that is applying there. It is wrong, and it's wrong on the basis of what we see to not give restitution in cases of theft or in cases of destruction of property and things like that. Restitution is the correct way of application, 100%. But the difference here is that the principle can be applied in a variety of ways. There's not one way that needs to be enshrined into law, if that makes sense. So the point is we're taking the principle of what the law is and we're trying to guide ourselves into thinking about that. We're looking at the specific application that we see in case law. We're tracing it through the general application, and we're also talking about creation principles. Those are the multi-step process that we're working through. Basically, we're looking at specific commandments, 10 commandments, and then Genesis 1 to 3. We're discerning application there. Let's look at another example. So Deuteronomy 23:19, you shall not charge interest on loans to your brother, interest on money, interest on food, interest on anything that is lent for interest. Okay? That's a very specific command, right? All right, now here's the thing that is really nice about Deuteronomy is that Deuteronomy is structured in such a way, it's structured in such a way that you can trace the specific commands to specific general commands. So this chart here is what I'm talking about, is the order and structure of Deuteronomy is, Deuteronomy 12 to 26 is basically modeled after the Ten Commandments. And so you can actually see where the general principle should be applied. This is why studying Deuteronomy is so fun and way easier in many ways than other laws. Because when you're reading a specific law, for example, here, Deuteronomy 23:19, you shall not charge it. Okay, well, just by the fact that it falls in Deuteronomy 23:19, you can see that it relates to the eighth commandment, do not steal, because that is Deuteronomy 23:15 through 24:7. All right? So with that in mind, we already know where that's traced to, and we have something similar here. We have don't charge interest to your brother. Well, that's related to the application of not stealing something. But, and this is something I hinted at before, is that laws in and of themselves are broader than just their negative statement. So the whole reason why you're not supposed to steal something is because you are to value what belongs to somebody else, respect that, and then also not withhold what is due somebody else. That would be the same thing as stealing. Technically, stealing would be taking something that belongs to somebody else and removing it, but in this case, we understand withholding something that belongs to somebody else is also a form of stealing. Okay? So the principle is still applying. And obviously, we understand, like last time, God created mankind with ownership and obligations, right? And so when we see this, there are certain aspects to this law that we principally are dutifully bound to apply. Now, for Israel, this was not charging interest to their fellow Israelite, right? So does that mean you are not allowed to charge any American's interest? Well, if you're going to take a direct correspondence, that's what you'd have to say, right? If you're going to say one for one, nation to nation, well, yeah, can't charge any American's interest. But of course, that's not the intent of the law. The law isn't intended to teach us that aspect of things. But the law is intended to teach us that there's something important about family. There's something important about brotherhood. I would say even within the church, we ought to be very, very intentional not to take advantage of our brothers and sisters, right? And so I think that that's a huge part of this process. There was one guy who, I actually just heard an example of this, of a guy who was lent a lot of money in a church, but the guy had to charge interest because the government stipulates if you make a loan over a certain amount, you have to charge a certain amount of interest. So he charged the minimum because it wasn't about making money off of a fellow Christian. He wanted to help him, but he also wanted to follow the laws of the government so that he was beyond reproach. And so he went down that road. And I think that's a helpful application of this, right? So I think in today's age, you know, if you were trying to apply this principle, you might say, okay, in general, the pursuit of wealth at the expense of what is most important is immoral. That's true. But how that applies can differ from situation to situation. So, for example, if I am working with my dad, which I have in the past, I borrowed money from him, and we work out situation of like, oh, I don't want you to pay interest on this. I do want you to pay interest on that or whatever. That's totally fine because I can do that. He's not taking advantage of me. He's being very generous. There's other scenarios where I might charge somebody a certain amount of interest because I understand the situation that they're in, that it's either them getting a bank loan for 20% interest, which would be ridiculous or something, versus I have to give them a minimum loan amount of 2%. Is that wrong? If I'm obligated from the government to say you have to pay me 2% interest, I don't think that we would say you are in the wrong by charging 2% interest. Now, let's say I think we can also be creative, because if that's too much, you could just give them the money back or something, right? They pay you interest, and then you say, and I love you, so I'm also going to give you a gift. Not a loan, but this is a gift, you know, something like that. And so all I'm saying is that there's flexibility. We're not under the letter of the law, but the principle is always still applicable. But that's kind of the difficulty if we were trying to mandate some sort of law on everybody that everyone had to follow the same standard. That would get really difficult really fast, because the scenarios are... That's why a lot of people, a lot of Old Testament scholars have talked about how the law functions as a body of wisdom literature after Christ comes. And the reason that language is used is because this is similar to how Proverbs talks about how we need to act in certain ways, but it doesn't give us a letter of the law. It gives us the guidance, the values that we need to apply. And so it's that's why there's a difference between the letter of the law, which says you need to go 65 miles an hour, versus you need to drive safely. You know, there's a difference, but they can have tremendous overlap. And so the same kind of thing is we're trying to backtrace these ideas. All right, so here's another one. This is like a really famous example, which I think really helps illustrate this point, used by a lot of people. I love it. So it says, when you build a new house, you shall make a parapet for your roof, that you may not bring the guilt of blood upon your house if anyone should fall from it. Okay, so the point is, in Israel, they had flat roofs, so they would build a fence around their roof so that somebody wouldn't fall off. But I don't know. I feel like most of us have the normal American house, which is like this, and I don't know, many of you are not partying on your roof. If you do, that's fine. But it's like most people aren't going to party on that. And so obviously the contextual, there's a tremendous contextual difference. But the principle applies, right? So again, tracing the structure of Deuteronomy, we see that 22:8 falls under the category of Commandment 6, which is thou shalt not murder. But thou shalt not murder, the positive affirmation of that isn't just, you know, try to avoid taking life whenever possible. Okay, that does not really helpful. It's also a positive affirmation of it is our obligation, based on the fact that man is created in God's image, to positively value life. That's our goal. So when we trace this, we understand that the whole foundation for the law against murder, or the reason why we value life as human beings, is because man is created in God's image. And so we are to value life. That's the most generic application of that. We're to protect life, to value it. And one of the ways that you can do that in Israelite society is to make a fence around your roof. That's just obvious, right? But does that law apply to us today? Well, certainly, if you lived in some parts of the world, it may be a direct application. Because if you live in some of the Middle Eastern countries, you may have a flat roof. And so you may want to have some guard structures there to avoid somebody falling off. But for us in North America, usually that's not the case. But the application is that we value life and protect it by taking precautions against danger. So maybe if you have a pool, maybe you have a pool cover, right? I mean, the application is there. There's so much valuableness, it's so valuable to taking the principle and applying it. But it is a little ridiculous to think that everyone would be required to have a fence around their roof in the way we build our houses, right? But that's the point. The law isn't intended to do that. The law is intended us to remind us, to teach us of the fact that we value life, and in specific situations, we do it in certain ways. But would the law require... Here's the thing. We could make a law saying everybody needs to have a pool cover. Well, that's one way we could do this, right? But what about building a fence around your pool? That would also be fulfilling the intent of the law, right? That would also be fulfilling the principle. Or what about draining the pool every time you're done using it? That might still be dangerous. I don't know. There's a lot of ways that you could take precautions, right? So that's, and I'm not saying there's no value to, like, for societies to make laws. I think obviously that's going to happen. But what we're talking about as Christians is how do we apply the law? And as you're reading Deuteronomy 22:8, you should feel no obligation to build a fence around your roof. But what you should get from this is that how can I make sure that I'm taking steps to value life, to protect it, to take precautions against danger? Maybe you need a baby gate at the top of your stairs for when your friends come over or something like that, right? So the kids don't fall down the stairs. That would be a proper application of the principle of this law. So again, we're going from creation principles. The whole reason we're valuing life is because man is made in God's image, right? And then general application comes from that creation principle, which in this case is value life, don't murder. And then the specific application of that principle would be something like Deuteronomy 22:8. All right, so that's where we were going to end last time, okay? But we got super delayed. So that's kind of an introduction to principalism. Now, what we're going to do here is kind of like, and we might bleed this over into the next session as well, is we're going to look at biblical examples of using the law. Okay? So this is the next part of our discussion is to, I've given theory, okay? I've given three theories. I think they're the best ones, although I think principalism is the best. And then let's look at how the Bible uses the law and see if we can ascertain patterns and whether or not we are correctly observing what's going on. All right, we don't need to review since we just talked about these things. For sake of time, I'm not going to go too much into this, but one... I will summarize and say that one interesting area of study, I'll give you like one or two just because I think it's so, it is helpful to be aware of, is that there is in the ancient Near Eastern law codes parallels with biblical law codes. Now, what I mean by that is, why am I telling you this? Because sometimes there's this weird thought that the law of God is special and, okay, it is special, but the thought goes that the law of God contains things that no society had ever thought of before, okay? That's sometimes what people think. But the reality is that there were lots of laws in the ancient Near East which were essentially identical to many of the laws that the Bible ends up preserving, okay? Now, what some liberal scholars do is they say, look, the Bible is borrowing from these other law codes. Okay, that's in some circles, that's what the argument is made. Actually, don't strike me down as a heretic, but that wouldn't be wrong for the Bible to borrow from other law codes. That's actually fine, okay? They're not mandated to do that. It's not necessary to do that, but it's not technically wrong. There are lots of times Paul quotes pagan philosophers and poets and things like that, and that's fine. Just because the Bible uses a different source doesn't mean that that's wrong. It just means that God is putting his stamp of approval on it. But the reason why I think it's helpful to look at these kinds of things sometimes is to just remind ourselves that there were also pagan societies that practiced similar laws. And there are multiple implications or applications. I think the biggest thing is just a reminder. Sometimes people think like, well, if we don't follow the biblical laws, societies are lost. Well, that's not necessarily true, because historically there have been, you know, many pagan societies that functioned with laws that were similar that predated biblical laws. So here's some examples. We won't go too much into this, but I just wanted to give a couple examples. Hammurabi's law code, for example, it dates from the 18th century. So just so we're aware, the Mosaic law dates to the 15th century, so 1400s BC. So this, the Hammurabi's law code, which was composed in Babylon, it predates the Bible by over 300 years, okay? So It has some specific laws that mirror or match the biblical laws very specifically. So on the left is Hammurabi's law code. On the right is Deuteronomy 19. So Hammurabi's law code says, if a senor accused another senor and brought a charge of murder against him but has not proved it, his accuser shall be put to death. If he came forward with false testimony concerning grain or money, he shall bear the penalty of that case. So in other words, if somebody comes and accuses somebody of a crime, he needs to be punished with what the person on trial would have suffered if he had been convicted. Okay, Deuteronomy is very similar. Judges shall inquire diligently, and if the witness is a false witness and has accused his brother falsely, then you shall do to him as he meant to do to his brother. So the point is that Hammurabi's Law Code, Deuteronomy 19, pretty similar with regard to what the law expects of truthful, accurate witnesses, and then bringing the judgment upon that individual if he falsely brought testimony against his brother. So the point being that there are similarities. Now, again, I don't think that the Bible is borrowing from ancient law codes or anything like that. I just think that this is evidence of the fact that because we're made in the image of God, there are certain observations we make as human beings where certain laws in societies are going to model themselves in fairness and justice, because human beings are sinful, they're depraved, but they're not completely corrupt in the sense that they still have the remnants of the image of God within them, right? So there's going to be cross-pollination like this. And by the way, this is not, I'm not putting my stamp of approval on everything that the Hammurabi's Law Code stands for. I'm just saying there are lots of laws. I give like four examples, but there are even more than that, of similarities, right? And so I think it's helpful to keep that in mind, just because on the one hand, you'll have people saying that the law of God is completely unique and never before seen. That's incorrect. But you also have people saying that the Bible is borrowing from other law codes, and that's not necessarily correct either. But even if they were, it's not wrong. God would just be saying, yes, this is a good principle of justice that we need to implement in this society of Israel. All right, so I'm going to skip over the other examples. We're going to do, we just have a couple examples of stringent application of Old Testament law, meaning that the letter of the law is applied in normative, exhaustive detail. So the Sabbath law is a really easy example of that. Exodus 35 talks about how on the seventh day you're supposed to have a Sabbath. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. That's pretty obvious. Then you have Numbers 15, 32 through 36, where the people of Israel were in the wilderness. They found a man gathering sticks on the Sabbath day. And those who found him gathering sticks brought him to Moses and Aaron and all the congregation. And all the congregation brought him outside the camp and stoned him to death with stones, as the Lord commanded Moses. So the point being that the law was given. If you violate Sabbath, you die. Here's a person who violates Sabbath, and he dies. So that's not surprising. That just, it's assumed that this is what's going to happen in many ways. Similarly, in Deuteronomy 13, you have the law that if there's a false prophet who tries to convince you to go after other gods, they are to be put to death. And then you have 1 Kings 18, where on Mount Carmel, Elijah achieves victory over the false prophets, and so he tells the people to seize the prophets of Baal, and they go and slaughter them at the brook. So those are just general applications of the law, right? So there are actually many more examples of this than what we even listed, but it shouldn't be surprising to us that the people of Israel, in looking at some of these examples, that they applied the law to the letter, right? But what's really surprising to people a lot of times is that there are examples of leniency in the law. And this is basically a strong argument for principalism even found in the Old Testament. So what I mean by leniency is actually the technical definition of leniency with regard to legal literature, where the law is not actually applied in the letter. And so some examples of this would be Leviticus 10, after the strange fire incident. So Nadab and Abihu are struck dead by God. They're consumed because of offering strange fire to God. And what ends up happening is that in Leviticus 10, you have Moses diligently inquiring about the goat of the sin offering. So basically, Aaron and his remaining sons, Ithamar and Eleazar, are offering the sacrifices of the people of Israel. They have to do the sin offering. And Moses comes back to find out what's going on. By the way, when Nadab and Abihu die, Moses forbids Aaron from mourning. So he says, don't let your hair down, like don't do anything. You have an obligation to serve the people. If you can't serve us, if you can't offer these sacrifices, we're toast. So you need to keep working. And so Moses says, you need to keep working, Aaron. And so Aaron comes, and Moses is coming back to find out how things have been going. And he finds out that the goat of the sin offering was burned up. Now, here's where you really need to know Old Testament law. Because if you study the sacrifices of Leviticus 1 through 7, you find out that as part of the sin offering, the priests were required to partake of the sin offering. And only the burnt offering of Leviticus 1 was to be entirely burned up. So here you have a violation of the law. Aaron and his sons burned the entire sin offering. It was supposed to be a sin offering, not a burnt offering, but they burned the whole thing up. Okay? So you have Moses getting pretty burned up himself, if you know what I mean. And so he says, why have you not eaten the sin offering in the place of the sanctuary, since it is a thing most holy and has been given to you, that you may bear the iniquity of the congregation, to make atonement for them before the Lord? Behold, its blood was not brought into the inner part of the sanctuary. You certainly ought to have eaten it in the sanctuary as I commanded. So, I mean, this is a pretty obvious example, right? I mean, Aaron and his sons did not follow the law. So what's Aaron's defense? So Aaron says in verse 19 of Leviticus 10, behold, today they have offered their sin offering and their burnt offering before the Lord, and yet such things as these have happened to me. He's talking about his sons dying. If I had eaten the sin offering today, would the Lord have approved? And when Moses heard that, he approved. Interesting, because what he's saying, in essence, is that Aaron said, would God really have been happy if I followed the letter of the law when all these things happened to me? And Moses says, you're right. God would not have approved if you just carried on as if everything was fine. And so this is really interesting because this shows, I mean, the letter of law is so clear here, right? The letter of law is absolutely clear. But what we see in this story, which is actually a part of the law itself, is that the law is not meant to be crippling. The law is not meant to be something that there are no exceptions to, nothing like that. Now, granted, like murder, pretty hard to find an exception to that. So there are some laws, obviously, which would be, by their very definition, unexceptional. But with something like this, with the procedures of sacrifice and law and whatnot, You have Aaron and Moses having this conversation. Moses originally is really mad that he didn't follow the law, and then Aaron says, listen, God wouldn't be pleased if I would have done that just because of everything that's happened to me. And Moses said, yeah, you're right. And so then they go on, right? And so you're like, okay, that's kind of interesting. What do we do with that? Well, I think the big application is just reminding ourselves that there are examples where very strong indication that the law is deeper than just obeying the letter of the law. There's principle. Even in contemporary law codes, we make a division between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, right? And so I think it's important to understand that. Another example would be the eating of the holy bread. So without reading the whole thing, David comes to Ahimelech the priest and says, hey, do you have any food for us? And Ahimelech says, well, I don't have any food, but I have the holy bread from the tabernacle that you could eat. Now, if you know your law, Leviticus 24:8-9 says, every Sabbath day Aaron shall arrange the bread before the Lord regularly. It is from the people of Israel as a covenant forever. And it shall be for Aaron and for his sons, and they shall eat it in a holy place, since it is for him a most holy portion out of the Lord's food offerings, a perpetual due. So in other words, the law is very explicit. Only the priests can eat of this bread. And then here you have Ahimelech saying, yeah, David, you can have this bread and eat this. And David seems to be fine with that too. And so why? Why is that allowed? Now, somebody might say, well, David's wrong, Ahimelech's wrong. I don't know. I don't really want to go there since it seems like Ahimelech dies for being faithful and helping out David, and it seems like David is being unjustly persecuted. I mean, it seems like they're on to something here. It seems like they're understanding something that maybe we don't get so well, and that's that the law, the letter of the law, was not meant to be crippling. In other words, the letter of the law wasn't worth David starving, if that makes sense. And so Ahimelech says, yes, this is the letter of the law, but let's give this bread to David and his men so that they don't starve. And yeah, I just think we have to do something with examples like these. There are others as well, but these examples seem to indicate that there is a difference, even in Old Testament. This is under the Old Covenant. There's a difference between the letter of the law and the spirit of the law, and I always grew up just thinking of the law as a stifling, you know, like normative experience where there were no exceptions. But the reality is that there are exceptions, and they seem to be sanctioned by God in these narratives. I don't have any other way to take it. And when we see those exceptions, it seems to indicate that, okay, the law isn't giving us, this is, okay, some of the laws are not telling us what is always right and what is always wrong, but they're guiding us through life. But then the circumstances of life will occasionally dictate that we do something else. And so that's why law and wisdom go hand in hand. There have been so many good scholarly articles written on the connection between law and wisdom, because even books like Proverbs have intersection with the law. And so when you're thinking of, yeah, we just can't view the law simplistically, and that's a great fear I have, is a lot of times if people just say, no, we need to obey the law, I think to myself, well, that's very, very simplistic, because even in the Old Testament, it wasn't just about obeying law. There are things that are deeper to the law. And so there are even times when in the Old Testament, they didn't even obey the law. And God said, that's okay, presumably. So when we think about this, the law was not meant to be blindly followed without consideration of context. It's the letter of the law, spirit of the law. The law was not exhaustive, but meant to be instructive on how to live in a variety of scenarios. Now, what I mean by that is really important, is that the law, the United States law code, is meant to be exhaustive. It's meant to be covering every single possible scenario. But for the biblical law code, it's guidelines. It's not meant to be exhaustive. It's meant to provide you patterns and principles by which we can evaluate life, right? And so the law was not meant to cover every single scenario possible. The examples would be like what we talked about with stealing oxen or sheep. Well, does that mean if you steal a goat or if you steal a chicken that you're exempt from the restitution requirements? Obviously not. The whole point is that a judge, a qualified judge, an elder of the people, would be able to say, based on the principles of the law, we would apply it to this scenario in this way. Okay? So my argument from even looking at the Old Testament is that principalization was already at play in the Old Testament. That was already a huge factor. Okay? So laws and principles often combined to help work through scenarios. All right, let's do we got time for a couple more, just one or two more, and we'll look at examples of the New Testament use of the law and see if that matches. So again, we've talked a lot about these, so I will just briefly fly by these. The Mosaic Covenant gives way to the New Covenant. We talked about that. Believers are no longer under the law, but are guided by the Spirit. And if principalism is correct, we should see the principles behind laws, and those principles have continuing validity, while at the same time, the applicability of the law changes based on the covenantal and contextual situation. So if principalism is correct, then the Deuteronomy 22:8 example would be a good illustration of that, where we don't have to build a fence around our roof. We can apply that in the variety of scenarios. Maybe we don't live in a place where we have pools, but maybe we live in a place where we live in like a mountain community where we should have fences along the cliffs or something like that. All right, so we've already talked about the three steps. So example number one, Jesus in Matthew 5. Jesus is always a good example. So you have heard that it was said of those of old, you shall not murder, and whoever murders will be liable to judgment. But I say to you that everyone who is angry with his brother will be liable to judgment. Whoever insults his brother will be liable to the council, and whoever says you fool will be liable to the hell of fire. So I always heard people say, well, Jesus was doing something completely brand new here. Well, I'm not convinced of that. I'm open to that, but I really think that you could have gotten to this place if you really understood how the law was to function anyway. Because if you go down the list here, tracing the principle, we understand that God created man in his image, and that's why we are to value life. And one of the ways that we value life is we don't get angry, mock, or mistreat our brother, right? That's just a very practical application of it. And so that seems to be what Jesus is doing here, is he's saying, you've heard it say you shall not murder, but it's not enough just to not murder somebody. You also need to apply that principle to everyday life, and you shouldn't get angry with your brother, you shouldn't mistreat your brother, because why? He's made in the image of God. That's a creation principle. So we're tracing these themes, these principles, and getting contemporary application. So that same thing would apply to a variety of areas of life. And so Jesus's statement, don't get angry or mistreat your brother, that makes sense to us because man is made in God's image, and so he's to be respected as an image bearer of God. So anytime you make fun of somebody or you get really upset with somebody, just remember that you are getting upset with somebody who stands in the place of God. And they are an image bearer of God. That's what it means to be an image bearer, is to stand in God's place. So again, we're just taking the creation principles, general application, specific application. All right, one more that we'll do, and then we'll break for lunch, is Paul on incest. So in 1 Corinthians 5, he talks about incest and says, hey, it's reported that there's an egregious form of sexual immorality among you, that a man has his father's wife. Now, I love this section because it's obvious Paul is relying on Leviticus here. This, if you know Greek, you can read the top. If you know English, you can read the bottom. The phrase that Paul uses here is basically directly correlated with Leviticus 18:8. So the wife of your father, the wife of his father. And so almost every scholar says, yes, Paul is drawing on Leviticus 18:8 here as the guiding principle for why they should know that it's wrong to have his father's wife. So this is a form of incest, and so he's having his father's wife. That's incorrect, and we know that because the law teaches us that, right? But, and just in case, we don't have time to go through this, but there's a lot of connections between Leviticus and 1 Corinthians. That was part of my dissertation, so my 200 pages of dissertation is found in this chart. There you go. But there's a lot of connections between 1 Corinthians and Leviticus. So Paul loves using the Old Testament, right? But there's change in how he uses it, right? So he's still deriving his moral ethic on sexuality from the laws, and we understand that because God creates sexuality. He creates man and woman, male and female, and he creates marriage, and he designs that to function a specific way. And then he gives laws which talk about why those or how that should look. And so Paul is able to derive his moral ethic from those laws. But there is difference. There's no mention of the death penalty associated with the law, but rather excommunication, and not from society, but from church. So he's making a couple changes there, and I think that's pretty significant. There are a variety of ways people have thought through this. Some people say, well, he could have only mandated the death penalty if he was in charge of the government or whatever. Well, I suppose that's possible, but it would seem strange that he wouldn't have talked about that, right? There are other mentions or applications of the law where the death penalty would have been expected in the Old Testament, but it's refrained. And so with regard to this excommunication rather than the death penalty, I think it should be at least considered. And then later on in 1 Corinthians, we also see Paul appealing to Leviticus to help define morality. But again, in 1 Corinthians 6:9, he says homosexuals will not have a place in the kingdom of heaven. But he also, again, doesn't mandate a specific penalty for them. He just says they won't have a place in the kingdom. But he's very clearly relying on Leviticus again there. So that's why I say similarity but with change, is that Paul is very clearly operating with a view to sexual morality, relying on the creation principles as displayed through different laws, but he's not incorporating every aspect of those laws, if that makes sense. He's applying the principle behind that. So the law retains what I would describe a didactic function, or you could call it a teaching function, a pedagogical function, while no longer holding a normative function. That seems to be the case with regard to Paul's examples as well. Now, last slide here. So when he traces this through, obviously God created male and female with marriage. Therefore, you shall not commit adultery, which is another way of saying respect marriage, keep marriage the right way, the way that I have intended it. And then one specific aspect of that is by not uncovering the nakedness of your father's wife. Okay? And so, because God designed marriage between one man and woman, then if there's any violation of that with pursuing same flesh, that's what we would define incest as, is the pursuit of same flesh, then that would be a perversion of God's creation design. And so, again, you have the creation principles functioning there. And so that mandates the creation principle itself is what determines whether something is right or wrong. All right, let's conclude with this thought, okay? Because I think this is really important to understand. So, is something wrong because the law says it's wrong, or is it wrong because God created the world to function a certain way and his character mandates a certain something? So, when I'm talking about the law, the way I would explain this, you are not, you know, you don't have to become my disciples, but the way I would explain this is that, put it this, okay, I'll explain it this way for this example, is that incest is not wrong just because the law says it's wrong, okay? Incest is wrong because God created marriage to be according to a specific definition, and incest does not follow that definition, okay? Same thing with, like, adultery, same thing with homosexuality. It's not that the law, by saying, you know, a man shall not lie with a man, that is a part of the Mosaic covenant, the Mosaic law, which is done away with. So I can't just say it's in the law, therefore it is wrong. But the reason it's in the law is because it's reflecting what God has done in creation. But other laws do not do that to the same degree. For example, the dietary restrictions. What can you find in creation that where God created the world in Genesis 1-3, what is found there that would relate to dietary restrictions? Well, there's actually not much. And actually, the dietary restrictions relate more so, according to Scripture, to the third commandment of not taking the name of the Lord in vain, which would mean that the dietary restrictions are not related as much to a creational principle as they are to representing God in a specific way at that time. We'll probably have to talk more about that because I see everyone getting hungry. But we need to talk more about those things when we get back from break. But in general, what we're going for in principalism is that we're trying to find the theological application behind a law. And it's not always going to be the same thing. It's not one size fits all. And so that's the goal, working backward. And something is wrong, continues to be wrong, even if we didn't have a command. Like I said, it was wrong for Cain to kill Abel even before the law existed, right? Because man is made in God's image. It's not because God said, thou shalt not kill Abel. So it's always an attempt to go back to creation and let that be our guiding principle. All right, more to be said on that in the next session. Let's pray.